Well, now we're ready to get into the thick of things. What we've been doing in the last couple of weeks is giving you a set of tools, some equipment with which we can now tackle specific problems and figure out what's going on, how things work, and possibly what to do about it. And we'll begin with what is, in many ways, I think, the most pressing of the various issues we'll talk about, the question of the environment. There's many attitudes you can take towards environmental issues. One attitude is, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. So what's the point? Why worry about the environment? Have a good time. Don't worry about it. Well, that's one response. It's one way of thinking about how we should relate to the world around us, that the effects of our actions on the world around us are of no concern unless they directly affect us. That, I think, is not a view that most people would defend, although occasionally you hear views that come close to defending that. The basic facts, I think, are pretty clear. There's a very long list of environmental problems that we face. Some of them are very immediate, water quality, air quality, lead in the water in Flint, toxins in the water in parts of Wisconsin, inadequate disposal of very toxic materials and the long-term risk of those toxic materials getting into the environment, and of course, increasingly, the question of climate disruption, of which global warming is the kind of general rubric under which this more complex set of climate issues is discussed. We are somewhere between a serious crisis and a complete catastrophe. You know, there's debates about how dire, among the various dire prospects we face, might be. At one extreme, there's an apocalyptic vision that we are at risk of destroying the very conditions of habitability of the planet in the medium to long term. That's the most extreme view among people who agree with the thesis that we are in a period of global warming. That's the most extreme view, but no scientist who has seriously studied these issues believes that this is only of minor concern and that it isn't going to cause enormous suffering and disruption in the lives of people if we fail to do something about it. The range is between a serious crisis and complete catastrophe. Well, here's what I want to do in this lecture. I'll begin by just presenting data, presenting basic information about the environmental conditions which we face and what the likely trends are into the future. Trends under the assumption that we don't do anything serious about it are particularly important. There are more positive trends which we'll discuss, projections depending upon whether or not we do something serious about these issues. So first I'm going to just give you a wide range of data, which I don't think ought to be controversial. They shouldn't be controversial any more than the data that tobacco causes cancer is controversial. That tobacco is an important cause of cancer is now absolutely settled science. That we face environmental crisis or catastrophe is settled scientific views. So first I'm going to present data. Then I'm going to apply the various tools that we've been exploring to try to explain why we got into this mess and what the obstacles are to doing something about it. I'm going to do that first as a general thing about environmental problems. How does the way our economy works, how does that contribute to these environmental issues? And then we'll focus more specifically on the specific issues that are bound up with global warming, which are not simply the same general issues that apply to all environmental issues. All right, so first, a range of facts of the matter. This is a graph that shows the conventional use, the use of conventional fossil fuels through, I think this particular graph, the actual data is through 2007, and the projected data then goes on to the end of the century. This simply shows, given what we know about the world's reserves of these particular sources of fuel, natural gas, coal, and oil, given what we know about those reserves, and predictions about the likely discovery of new reserves. So, you know, how much there is in the ground is obviously something you don't have absolute knowledge about. There's geological surveys, there's efforts to find it, including in very inaccessible places, such as miles under the sea floor. But given what we know about the reserves, this is what the state of those reserves will look like as we use it. Now, one thing is absolutely certain. This is, nobody could plausibly disagree, I think, is that the reserves of fossil fuels on this planet are finite. There's not an infinite amount of oil, natural gas, and coal. It's a finite resource. And eventually we'll run out of it if we keep using it at the rate we're using it now. If we keep burning up this stuff, eventually there won't be any left. We're a planet with, I think, 7 billion people now. I'm not sure if my number is exactly right, somewhere in that vicinity. If 7 billion people aspire to use natural resources at the rate that we in the developed world and we in the United States use, if that's their aspiration, that's the model for how you live a good life, and we keep burning this stuff up, eventually we'll run out. Now, whether we begin to run out in the course of the next 3 or 4 decades or in the next 1 or 2 centuries, of course, there's debate about how rapidly we'll use it up. And the rate at which we use it up will depend in part upon what substitutes we get for these natural resources. Some sources of energy are inexhaustible. The sun is inexhaustible. Wind is pretty inexhaustible. Well, it's inexhaustible. How much it can provide is another question. So there will be substitutes that will occur, and that may slow the rate, but it's still the case. As long as we keep burning it up, it'll eventually be depleted. Well, why does that matter? Well, it matters because some of these substances, particularly oil resources, are useful for all sorts of things other than burning up. Lots of pharmaceuticals, plastics, all sorts of products that we use, many of which can be reused, recycled, are also made from petroleum. So if you have a resource that you know what you're going to run out with, and some of it provides extremely useful things, and others you can just burn up for which there's substitutes, well, you can ask yourself, should we be worried about this? Or should we just merrily go along our way and treat this as a resource worthy of combustion? Well, that's not about global warming or anything of that sort. That is simply a point about using up, or conservation, using up non-renewable resources. This is a graph of the 5-year average, that's the red line, and annual average temperatures compared to the long-term average temperature globally during the period 1880 to the present. And as you can see, there's been a steady, sharp increase in average global temperatures, beginning at the turn of the century with a plateau in the middle part of the 20th century, but accelerating quite dramatically since 1980. This is a more up-to-date graph from the New York Times in January, which shows that the highest monthly temperatures relative to the average for that month occurred in the last year. Here's another way of showing the same graph. This is average monthly temperatures by month and the years in which the record highest averages occurred. And 2014, 15, and 16 were the 3 years in which record high temperatures for the planet, since we've been recording temperatures, occurred. These are projections. The part of the graph to the left of the vertical line are historical observations. That's actually the trajectory that we've observed. The projections depend upon models, right? So that's how you do a projection. The strategy, it's really interesting from a technical point of view, the strategy is to create a model in which you try to include all of the forces that you know contribute to the global average temperature. So CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere are one of the crucial things that people, that scientists know contributes to global temperature. Carbon dioxide absorbs heat better than the other components of our atmosphere, and the higher the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the more heat will be retained. The physics of that are firmly established. And the fact that carbon dioxide concentrations have increased because we burn fuels that emit carbon dioxide is also unequivocal, unambiguous. So one of the things that determines what that trajectory is the concentration of carbon dioxide. So you have a model in which you include the known values of carbon dioxide in the past, along with other things, the heat absorption capacity of the oceans, ground cover of forests around the world, all sorts of other elements fit into this, into these models. And you have a model that's at least a candidate for a good predictor of the future if, when you put in the actual values of all these variables in the past, you track the historical trajectory really well. So if you put the carbon dioxide concentrations of 1900, 1920, 1930 every year, and you put all the other parameters that we know about, and your model really knows how these things fit together, and it reproduces the historical data really well, it matches, it fits those data really well, then you have at least some reason to believe, if we make estimates into the future, if we say, suppose carbon dioxide rises to this level, that your predictions for the future will at least have some credibility. The better you can fit the historical data, the more confidence you have that your projections make sense. Now, when scientists do this, they always do a range of projections, because what we don't know for the future is actually what the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere will be in the year 2100. We don't know that. That's a different kind of prediction, because that prediction depends upon what human beings do, among other things. It depends upon complicated interactions between global warming and other properties of the planet. Just to give you one little example, which many people have begun to give a great deal of attention to, in the northern latitudes in the northern hemisphere, there is a form of terrain that's called tundra. Tundra is normally frozen year-round. It thaws on the very top layers during the summer, but it's frozen below. And it never thaws thoroughly because of the northern latitude. Well, one of the consequences of global warming will be a thawing of the tundra. That part of our global landscape is going to become mushy, swamp-like, for part of the year. When tundra thaws, it gives off methane. It's another decomposition of organic materials. Gives off methane. And methane turns out to be a much more potent greenhouse gas than even CO2. So as methane gets released from the northern latitudes because of the thawing of the tundra, as that happens, global warming will accelerate. So the kind of logic of this is CO2 increases global warming, that triggers another source of global warming, the thawing of the tundra. Well, that didn't form part of the early equations. That is, in the early equations when people predicted global warming, they didn't include methane from the tundra. They hadn't thought of that as an additional factor. In the last 15 or 20 years, people have become aware that the thawing out of the tundra is a big deal and ultimately could matter even more than CO2 because it absorbs heat so much more readily. Now, how much methane is going to be released by the tundra, that we can only estimate. The models that try to figure out how much methane is stored there, how much will get released, and how rapidly it'll be released, well, that's much less firmly established than the problem of the amount of CO2 that's produced when you have coal-fired plants. We know really well the amount of CO2 put into the atmosphere by driving internal combustion engine cars and by having coal plants. That has been really well worked out. Exactly how much methane gets released by the tundra, that's part of the science that's still in progress. And that's one of the reasons why there's disputes about how catastrophic the future is. If you take the maximalist view as to how much methane is going to be released, well, then we really have a dire global warming problem that will massively disrupt much of the world. If, on the other hand, the methane release problem isn't quite as serious as the worst-case scenarios, well, perhaps then we're only at the serious crisis rather than the catastrophe level. So that's the ambiguities. Okay, that's just so you know, the science does have ambiguities. It does not have ambiguities that we face a very, very serious problem. It has ambiguities about how serious it is, and things like methane and tundra are part of the reasons for that ambiguity. Okay, well, here are two projections into the future. The highest pathway is that we just keep doing what we're doing now. Drill, baby, drill. You know, drill, baby, drill is the slogan of just keep doing what we do now. It's too costly for our economy to do anything about it. The best thing is just to go about our own business, and ultimately market forces, the argument goes, will correct things. Because if we keep doing this, then the market is somehow going to tell us to stop doing it. Well, the feedback process from markets for environmental harm are extremely weak signals. The feedback of markets for running out of oil would be strong. That is, if the only issue was that we were going to run out of this resource once the supply began to decline and demand kept rising, the price of oil would shoot through the roof. And that would be a terrific market signal to do something else. You know, in one sense, it's unfortunate that in that previous graph, this one back here, it's unfortunate that the peak is estimated to be sometime in the 2020s. It would have been really great if we began running out of oil about 20 years ago. I mean, if we had begun running out of oil so the supply began to plummet 20 years ago, we would have been forced to do something about fossil fuels because the price of gasoline for cars would be $20 a gallon. You'd see a very big demand for electric cars and alternative sources of energy if that had happened. Unfortunately, for the relationship between our capacity to burn fossil fuels and the supply of the fuels to burn, unfortunately for that relationship, we have too much oil in the ground still available, which means the temptation to drill, baby, drill as a way of providing adequate energy for people to live their lives the way they want remains unabated. The lower line here, the lower pathway says, this is what it would look like if we right now take drastic steps. If we really say, yes, the future is not distant, this is a problem that's going to be hitting some of the people alive today, the serious problems will hit our grandchildren, your grandchildren, for those of you who hope to form families, will face these dire consequences. And since you will care and love and worry about the well-being of those concrete human persons, you should do something now, not wait till the catastrophe hits. Well, if we responded that way, then there's a prospect that we would hit this lower line in terms of how much global, what the new steady state of global temperatures would be. Just some more slides. These are all telling in different ways the same sort of stories. This is the shifting distribution of summer temperature anomalies. An anomaly is a temperature that is above or below the average by a particular standard, by the number of degrees indicated on the bottom, on the horizontal axis. For the historical norms of 1951 to 1980. So from 1951 to 1980, you see it's a nice bell-shaped curve where there are as many anomalies that are a half a degree or more above normal as there are a half a degree or more below. So you have a nice bell-shaped curve. As you move forward, the anomalies shift to the right, meaning that it's much more frequent to have hotter than average days in the summer than cooler than average days in the summer. And the extreme anomalies increase in an especially strong way. This is United States daily temperature extremes from the 1950s to 2012. And again, in the 1950s, if you're asking what was the record, how many record highs and record lows did you have? There's a rough balance of record highs and record lows. As you see, as we move to the present, record highs greatly outnumber record lows. This is a graph showing the relationship between CO2 concentration. This isn't CO2 emissions. It's carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere and global temperatures. Now you can see that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere isn't the only thing that could be affecting global temperatures. There is variation throughout this period. The global temperature chart doesn't strictly track the trajectory of the CO2 concentration, but it's pretty close. Another indicator. This is what's happened to the global, to the Arctic ice sheet at the end of the summer. September 19th, 2012, the Arctic ice sea up to that point reached its lowest extent ever. And now people are talking about the possibility of there being sea traffic through the Arctic year-round because of the melting of the global ice sheet. Environmentalists like to show pictures of polar bears stranded on ice floes as a way of creating a kind of sentimental aversion to the destruction of the global of the Arctic ice sheet. And it's totally understandable why the polar bear is an attractive symbol. You know, polar bears have a kind of romantic image, especially when you see polar bear cubs rolling around down snowy hills. You get these fantastic videos of the life and times of polar bears. And of course, it's understandable why, from a kind of public relations point of view, you want to stress the impact on the lives of a beautiful creature. But that's a small piece of the problem with the melting of the ice sheets. A salient piece symbolically, but a small piece of the problem. The real problem with the melting of ice sheets in the Arctic and Antarctic and the melting of glaciers in Greenland, which is one of the additional consequences of global warming, is that this is going to lead to rises in sea levels around the world, which, depending upon how close to the ocean you live and what the particular properties of the terrain are, you know, if you live on the west coast of California where there are cliffs for much of the west coast that separate the landmass from the ocean, a rise of a meter or two of the ocean is not going to affect Big Sur that much, that region of California with cliffs. If you live in southern Florida, Louisiana, a modest rise in sea levels will have a devastating effect on the people who live there. This graph shows estimates for what the sea level rise scenario is for the United States by the year 2100, depending upon again, these conjectures about how much global warming will there be and whether we do anything about it. In this particular case, there's an additional problem because you have to also in your model include how does global warming affect the rate at which the ice sheets in the north, the glaciers in Greenland, and in the Antarctic, how do these respond to global warming? How rapidly will they melt? These are the states which are at risk from global sea warming, and the populations that are located in the vulnerable places. And then the next few slides just show examples using maps that indicate where the vulnerable spots are. How high above sea level are you? We're okay in Wisconsin. Lake Michigan isn't going to rise, as far as I know. And we're at, I think, 600 or 800 feet above sea level and something like that in the Madison area. The highest places in Wisconsin are, 1,500, 2,000 feet above sea level maybe. So we're not going to be inundated. But southern Florida, look at Louisiana. All of those areas will be threatened. And to say they're threatened, it means they're threatened both because just the sea level rises, but they're really threatened because of what happens when there's hurricanes and particularly high tides. You have to protect yourself against not just the stable average sea level, but what happens when there's storms and the like. This is already a problem in parts of the country. It will become a massively worse problem. And in some parts of the world, Bangladesh, for example, it's a problem that will devastate tens of millions of people's lives. And here this brings up another aspect of the global warming problem. Global warming is going to affect everybody globally. It's not going to affect just your neighbor, it's going to affect you. So this is a case where our behaviors in the past and in the present are going to affect everybody. But it's clearly going to affect some regions of the world in much more devastating ways. It's going to make some parts of the world uninhabitable. The most obvious example are very low-lying islands in the Pacific, where there are islands which will disappear that currently are the homes for people who have lived there for thousands of years. They cannot continue to live on those islands. And there is already plans for the relocation of entire populations from some Pacific islands to other places. But Bangladesh poses a particular problem. It has a very large population, it's extremely poor, and they have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to go. And then here is the kind of moral issue. Aside just from the humanity and human suffering issue, the causes of global warming are because of the behavior of people and countries, governments, in the richest parts of the world. That's where the carbon emissions come from. Overwhelmingly, they come from the wealthy parts of the world. The United States has about 5% of the world's population, and we contribute about 18% of global carbon emissions. The carbon emissions are the result of what we do in the rich part of the world, but the costs of living with the effects of global warming, and particularly the most catastrophic circumstances, where desperate human suffering will take place, are in places in the world which did not contribute to the problem. Now, talk about a moral issue of fairness that I think no moral theory can say is fair. No one with a straight face, I think, can say there's no problem of justice in rich countries creating a problem of global significance that destroys the lives of millions of people in poor countries, for which they bear no responsibility. The mantra of contemporary American culture around risk is you should bear the costs of your own choices. You should be responsible Well, it's irresponsible in the deepest possible way for us to benefit from a series of practices which has made life comfortable and easy for us if it has the consequence of destroying the lives and creating huge suffering for millions of people elsewhere in the world. That is what is called the problem of environmental justice. Now, the problem of environmental justice is a separate issue from simply the problem of global warming as such. Global warming is a problem even if you bracket away the injustice of global warming with respect to who's going to suffer most and who's going to suffer least. Who bears the burdens of this phenomenon? These are two separate issues. They're both important. Well, that's our little rapid tour through the data. Now let's turn to the general explanatory problem. What I want to review then are five explanations for environmental problems in general. So these bear on any environmental problem that you might think of. Five general explanations, and then we will look specifically at how these apply to the questions of global warming. First, individual lack of concern for the environment and individual free riding. This is a very commonly held view of American environmental problems. People just don't care. They don't recycle because they can't be bothered. They're not ecologically conscious. This is the standard way that problems of things like pollution at the individual level are dealt with. If in the 1980s there was a public service ad on TV that featured a character called Woody the Owl. You can Google it and see it on YouTube. It's kind of cute. And what this charming little owl says is, "Give a hoot, don't pollute." And the whole message is a bunch of cheerful children wandering around in the woods and picking up trash and putting it into a trash bin. And the central idea there is that we need to change the culture of people so that they care about the environment and therefore they don't individually pollute. You don't individually throw your trash in the park. You say, no, I don't do that, and put it in the trash bin. Well, the culture, of course, matters, and how much individuals individually feel they have a personal responsibility to not pollute, to not impose harms on the environment, of course that matters. But we've developed some tools that help us understand a little bit more about how that actually works. And here I think the idea of free riding can be seen as particularly relevant. So here's an example of an environmental problem from individual free riding. The numbers I've put in here are phony. I've just made up numbers so that you can, to illustrate the idea. So suppose you have to decide, am I going to recycle or should I not bother? And you recognize that recycling is good for the environment. It means we deplete resources less, we have less costs for landfills. That's an important issue. So you believe that recycling is a good thing. There's no problem in why you don't recycle if you actually think it's a pointless thing to do. Right? So that's not, there's a problem, but that's a different problem. So I'm taking a person who does recognize that yes, the world is a better place if everyone recycles than if no one recycles. That's a better place to live. It accomplishes some good goals. But you still have to decide, am I going to bother doing it? Well, here's the classic free rider story. You got your choice and everyone else's choice. You control only what you do. You have no influence on what other people do. And all you care about is what you're going to get out of it, yourself. You're the selfish individualist, remember. What am I going to get out of it? Suppose that the individual annual cost of recycling is $50. $50 in the sense of the how much it cost you in time and effort to do it. So I'm imputing a monetary value to just the trouble it takes to do it. You know, to take your stuff, put them in the right bin, take the right bin and put it in the right place. So let's imagine it costs you $50 a year. And the long-term benefit of having recycling is $100 because of savings in the cost of landfills and the improved efficiency of less waste and recycled materials. So you ask yourself, if I don't recycle and everybody else does, my long-term benefit is $100. I haven't done the effort, I still get the benefit. If everybody recycles, my benefit is $50. You get the long-term benefit of $100, but you also get the, you have to pay the $50 of time and trouble. If nobody recycles, well, there's no benefit, but there's no cost. If I am this purist and I recycle and nobody else does, well, it still costs me $50, but the long-term benefit disappears. The long-term benefit only comes from large-scale recycling. I've described that as what everyone else does. Of course, it's more complicated. It could be what 90% of everybody does. You know, you can nuance this story, but this is the simpler way to tell it. So what do you do if you're, what are your preference orders? BADC, standard free rider problem. Well, if that's, and if everybody behaves that way, if everybody believes that recycling is a good thing to do, but everybody is also a selfish individualist, where all they care about is what is it going to cost me and what's my benefit going to be. So they understand the aggregate benefit from which they will participate, but they figure, I can get that benefit without the sacrifice. Ooh, that's cool. If everybody is like that, then you don't get recycling. Well, there are solutions to environmental free riding. There are solutions. I think because of time and the amount of stuff I want to get through today, I won't have us break down, but I'll just ask you. What are solutions? How do you deal with a situation where everybody recognizes it's a good thing to do, but people want to be free riders? What do you do about it? What's the solution? Come on. I could just randomly call on somebody, but I hate to put people on the spot. I know two-thirds of you know know answers to this question. How would you solve this problem? If you're a policymaker or a politician and you want to solve this free riding problem, what would you propose? Yeah.
You could create benefits to give people for recycling, I suppose.
So you could try to bribe people into doing it. You could actually pay people to recycle, so you could take some of the long-term costs and turn it into a bribe. It would need to be a bribe of at least $50 a person, otherwise it doesn't compensate them for their troubles. That's a pretty big bribe given the benefits. Yeah, there was a hand up. Yeah. Post fines, mandatory recycling. Well, that's a pretty good idea and it seems to work, but it does mean you're coercing people to do something individually which they don't want to do. But it's a good solution for a lot of environmental free riding. There was a hand back there. Okay, other ideas, yeah. Very good point. One of the things as a policymaker you can do is say, can we lower the costs that people face? Can we make it easier? Because in fact, people tend to have thresholds for free riding. If it's not a lot of bother, a lot of people will do it. If it's a big bother, you have to take your stuff, separate it into green glass and clear glass and take it to a recycling center. You gotta have a hell of a lot of commitment to recycling to do that. So one thing to do is to try to develop new technologies, that's one way. But other ways of doing it where you reduce the burden on the individual and make good behavior part of a habit. Other ideas, yeah?
Deposits on things?
deposits on things. Yeah, that's a, deposits work pretty well. That's a way of, you initially charge somebody for a bottle, and then you refund the particular extra charge. That's a kind of bribe and punishment combined together, right? So you've punished them by having the deposit on the bottle, which they pay for if they don't throw, if they throw it away, and then you reimburse them for that cost if they do. And you use that extra charge for covering recycling costs. Any other thoughts? Yeah. Right, so that's interesting, and it has all sorts of complicated social implications. Certainly in poor countries, having a market that typically a market that's underwritten by municipalities or the government for recycled material, and then having poor people act as scavengers that roam the streets looking for bottles and cans and cardboard, and they then get paid. There is, in some places in Latin America, unions of pickers. Pickers meaning people who pick these things up, who then demand from the city living wages for doing all this work. Well, that's a particularly interesting solution in some contexts where you can use the benefits of recycling also as a way of supporting the initiative, often quite entrepreneurial initiative, of poor people to find ways of living under dire conditions. That's not such a viable solution in rich countries, and to the extent that it is, it reflects failures in other public policies, that is to have sufficient numbers of homeless, desperate people on the streets to do the recycling work that citizens could otherwise do. All right, that's the first type of explanation, individual behavior, particularly when it intersects these free riding kinds of problems. Second general type of explanation, negative externalities of both individuals and of firms. Negative externalities of individuals are situations in which individuals engage in environmental practices that don't harm them at all. So it's not a case of recycling, you know, the story there where there's a free riding problem, but it in particular might harm future generations. We can call that an intergenerational negative externality, displacing costs onto future generations because of our present choices, as individuals I'm talking about here, not our choices, the choices of firms. An example of this has to do with energy use, the percent of global energy use and the percent of global population. As you can see, the United States has by far the greatest disproportion between our population and the percent of global energy use of any country or region of the world. And one way of thinking about that is that Americans are displacing costs onto future generations, even aside from the global warming issue. We're displacing costs because of the future depletion of those resources. This is another graph. This is the same argument, but as it applies to CO2 emissions and thus to global warming. A particular form of negative externality in which people's own practices impose costs on others at the individual level are what are called NIMBY externalities. NIMBY, not in my backyard. The classic NIMBY situation is, where should we place toxic wastes? Where should we place toxic waste? Should we place them in neighborhoods with where rich people live, or in neighborhoods where poor people live? Where should we place toxic waste? Nobody wants a toxic waste in their neighborhood. Nobody wants it in their backyard. Communities organize almost inevitably to oppose the location of a toxic incinerator, a toxic waste, or any such facility anywhere close to where they live. People organize and say, not here. Well, what kinds of communities are most effective in that organizing? Well, of course, it's affluent communities where they have the resources to hire lawyers, to protest in court, to cause trouble for city councils. And what city planning agencies typically do when they look over the array of options is they say, well, where should we place this where we're going to get the least flack? Where should we place this toxic waste facility where we will get the least blowback? And the answer is near poor people. And in particular, in some parts of the country, it's near poor minority communities. In California, this is data that's presented in the chapter in the book. If you look at census tracts in California by cancer risk from toxins in the air. So toxins in the air reflect some kind of specific kind of facility that's close by, because it varies across areas. And toxic waste disposal areas are one of the sources of toxins in the air. If you look at the distribution of census tracts by the racial composition of those tracts, those with the highest, in the highest third of risk, are predominantly non-white, and those with the lowest risk of exposure are predominantly white. And it's hard to tell a story in which that is somehow just an accident, that there isn't any policy preferences that result in the location of toxic emissions that produce these results. And the standard story is NIMBY. And there's lots of evidence that NIMBY works. That is, if you mobilize to oppose and cause trouble for the location of a toxic waste facility, it makes it less likely it'll be sited near you. Economists have another kind of justification for this, one which I understand, but it certainly rubs me the wrong way. They say, well, property values are more valuable in rich neighborhoods than in poor neighborhoods. And if we located this toxic facility near high property value areas, we would be causing more economic damage than if we located near poor areas. Because we would be affecting the property values of high property valued areas, whereas in the crappy low property value areas, you can't do much damage to those property values because they're not much worth much anyway. Well, there's a rationale for that. They don't say, oh, and the rich people who live there have more valuable lives. That would cross a line, I think, in terms of how you would argue for this. But there's a kind of implicit assumption that we're not going to worry about that part of the value of and cost of producing, of location. The British Petroleum oil spill. This was an oil spill in the mill. If the oil spill had occurred inland in Wisconsin, that's the area it would have covered from Milwaukee west. If we look in southern Alabama, southern Louisiana and the Gulf areas as to which parts of the Gulf area were most affected by the oil spill because of where they dumped the waste from the oil spill, you see that the oil spill was placed in locations where there were high concentrations of minorities. Again, that's a NIMBY problem, which is a form of negative externality, imposing costs on others for your own benefit. But there is another kind of NIMBY problem, another kind of negative externality problem, which is more fundamentally important. I mean, the toxic waste issue is important for the lives of people, but to the extent that that is the result of the collective action and mobilizing capacity of relatively affluent people, It has consequences. I don't think it's a major source of the negative externalities of environmental practices. What's much more hardwired into the nature of our economic system, more fundamental to how it really works, are the negative externalities of profit-making firms. And here is the central proposition. For capitalist firms, pollution is not just an accident. In general, the most profitable economic strategies will be the most polluting because they successfully displace costs on others. The most profitable strategies will, in general, be the most polluting because they successfully place costs on others. Note the difference in the incentives of a firm with respect to oil spills inside of a factory or a facility and oil spills in the environment. Now, an oil spill that occurs inside of a factory is a cost that is directly experienced by the owner of the factory. They have to clean up their internal pollution, so to speak. We can call that a negative internality, not externality. It's a negative cost that you're imposing on yourself because you weren't careful and you had an oil spill. Well, firms are going to do a lot to prevent their own machinery leaking, their own internal pipeline, so to speak, busting. Imagine if we had oil pipelines with no regulation. That is, we didn't ask the question, what is the probability of it having a spill, and how would it affect the environment? Where are the environmentally vulnerable places, and where are the places which are not so vulnerable? And we don't require them to have shutoff valves at relatively close intervals so that they can stop the damage of a spill quickly. And we don't require them to have double-lined pipes because that makes spills less likely, et cetera, et cetera. Suppose we really got rid of the regulations on the grounds that, of course, the oil companies don't want spills. An oil spill is a cost. They're losing oil. They have to fix it for their own benefits. So they will worry about it enough. The market will take care of it. But we don't want to regulate it because regulation is a government interference in the free market. Would you predict that we would have more or less serious and environmentally destructive oil spills in the absence of heavy regulation of oil pipelines, requiring that they avoid the most vulnerable ecological places and that they install all sorts of safety and preventative measures? Well, I think it's pretty obvious that you'll have fewer oil spills, and when they occur, they will occur in less vulnerable places if you have serious and careful regulation of this technology. If you prevent firms from displacing costs onto others. Negative externalities are pervasive in market-oriented, profit-maximizing economic systems, and it doesn't require that the producers be evil people. They are certainly not imposing costs on others because they have a malicious desire to harm other people. The motivation is not to destroy the environment and to make life difficult for people. No, the motivation is simply to minimize costs and maximize profits. And that's what their job is. That's what they're judged on. That's what they're judged on by the stock owners. That's what they're judged on by their fellow managers and chief executive officers. They're judged by how profitable and effectively they compete. In effect, then, regulating negative externalities is regulating competition. It's saying we don't want firms to be competing on how effectively they can impose costs on other people. We're going to block that form of competition. That form of competition is harmful, even if it's successful. Of course it's successful. You get a problem, of course, when in some countries allow competition on the basis of displacing costs onto other people, and you want to avoid it. Well, then you get the argument, American firms will be less competitive with Chinese firms, let's say, if we prevent them from harming other people, but in China they don't, or in some other country they don't. So international competition does make this more complicated. It does make it harder to constrain negative externalities domestically if you're competing with actors who are unconstrained with respect to that particular strategy of maximizing your profits and lowering your costs. That is indeed a problem. What's called the race to the bottom, that expression, race to the bottom, is a competitive situation in which the bad actions of one segment of the competitive market, because of the particular constraints and regulations which they face, forces other people to race to the bottom, to adopt equally bad practices. That's the race to the bottom. And there is a serious question, what do you do about it? How do you contend with that? Well, I think you can contend with it, and I think contending with it by saying it's fine to impose those costs on other people here because those costs are imposed elsewhere is not a legitimate way of dealing with it, and it certainly doesn't show the virtues of the market. What it shows is the trap and problem of the market, for which some kind of solution needs to be found if we at all believe that markets ought to properly reflect the costs, the true costs of production. In the slides, you'll see links, and this will be online, you'll see links to two short videos about Love Canal. We don't have time here to show them, but I really would encourage you to look at these. It's discussed in the chapter as well. Love Canal is a famous story in upstate New York near Buffalo, where a chemical company at the beginning of the 1950s dumped highly toxic waste into a canal that existed behind the factory. And when the factory stopped producing this, they simply dumped soil over the toxic waste and turned it into a kind of meadow. Subsequently, there was a housing development that backed onto this area. And that housing area, the families began to notice serious health problems. They also built an elementary school on this meadow because the land was cheap. And the rate of miscarriages, birth defects, and cancer skyrocketed in this area. Eventually, there was popular mobilization by the residents, led by a particular woman who is interviewed in the first of these two videos. And eventually, it was recognized as the worst example of an environmental pollution to save costs in the United States, and led to the toxic waste disposal, the super fund to, for us collectively as taxpayers to deal with these problems. That was a successful displacement of costs. The chemical company at the time knew what it was doing. It knew these were very, very toxic chemicals. It's not an instance where something that was thought to be of no consequence at time one turns out to be devastating at time two. No, they knew that this was highly toxic. They did not share with the residents who bought the houses that there was highly toxic chemicals right below their houses. So this is not a case of innocence, but it was a case of profit maximizing through negative externalities. These problems continue today. There are serious problems in Wisconsin of toxins in the water supply in parts of the state due to very similar kinds of practices. All right, that's the second thing. Second source of environmental problems, negative externalities of individuals, displacing costs, NIMBY, displacing costs on future generations, and especially of profit-maximizing firms. A third aspect of a third part of the explanation of environmental problems I would like to separate from simple negative externalities, and this is the actual strategies of powerful actors. So it's not just that the individual corporations themselves acting just as corporations displace costs. They also mobilize their resources to hide the fact that they displace costs, to resist public regulation, and to seek subsidies for themselves. This is a little chart of the subsidies for energy from the US government. Subsidies, this is actual use of taxpayer money to support particular kind of energy sources. It's not the case that oil and natural gas development in the United States is just the result of the way the market works. It's the result of the way the market works, plus in the half century since 1950, over $700 billion of subsidies for energy, 50% of which went to oil and natural gas. Now, I have actually no objection to taxpayer money being used to subsidize particular sectors. That can be good public policy. When we get to the discussion of transportation, I'm going to be gung-ho about taxpayer subsidies to certain kinds of transportation systems, because some kinds of subsidies reduce negative externalities. Some kinds of subsidies actually help things work better. The subsidies to energy have created a terrific bias as to what kinds of energy and energy infrastructures get developed. And this is not the result simply of the way the market works, it's a result of public policy. Another indicator of the way the power of strategic actors has affected environmental issues is reflected in the budgets of the Environmental Protection Agency as a percentage of the total US federal budget. As you can see, in its early years, it approached 1% of total federal expenditures was on environmental protection. Powerful actors whose interests were threatened by the EPA didn't like that, and they mobilized to reduce the effectiveness of the Environmental Protection Agency, reducing the allocation of actual funds available for it to pursue environmental protection from around 1% to less than 4%, 0.4% of the federal budget. And as I'm sure you all know, the current administration wishes to dramatically reduce environmental protection funding even further. It wants to cut by 75%, at least it's announced that it wants to, the actual regulations in place, and to dramatically cut spending for environmental protection. In the face of corporations and powerful interest groups that have an interest in pollution, a positive interest in negative externalities, reducing environmental protection will predictably have the effect of reducing the quality of water, reducing the quality of air, and accelerating the emission of greenhouse gases. Consumerism run amok. Consumerism run amok. Hyper-consumerism. Well, we're going to have a lecture next Thursday on consumerism, on how the biases in our economy, which direct people's activity towards ever-escalating levels of consumption, that this isn't just individuals making their own free choices. There are systematic pressures and biases in the system, which both create cultural standards which push people towards consumerism, but also make it more difficult for people to create balance between leisure and consumption. There are obstacles to a less consumerist lifestyle. We'll be discussing that in detail in the lecture next Thursday. And given time, I'm going to skip over that here. It's in the chapter as well. Finally, a fifth point about, in general, how do we explain the environmental problems we have? I think it's important to think of market ideologies as blocking solutions. So for any kind of social problem, that you might be interested in for any sort of social problem. You can say, what are the causes of that problem? And what are the obstacles to a solution? And sometimes the causes are the same as the obstacles, right? So sometimes you can say, well, it's powerful actors that cause the problem and it's powerful actors which get in the way of a solution. But sometimes it's possible to identify specific elements that really get in the way of doing something about it, that interfere with our capacity to solve problems, rather than simply this is a source of the problem. And here I think market ideology plays a particularly important role. Because the free market ideology basically says, in principle, markets are the best solution to any problem, and that government which governs least governs best. That governments are plagued by incompetence and malevolence. Remember those two claims about the free market ideology? You might think that government could solve this problem, but no, stay away from it because it's incompetent and it's malevolent. It's incompetent and malevolent. When the opponents of climate change, the climate change denier industry, says that the scientists who support the thesis that human beings have created climate change, that it's anthropogenic, that it's the result of human action, that they're doing this in order to get more grants. Right? So the claim is these are scientists manipulating the data so that they can feather their own nests and get more research grants. That view says, particularly government scientists, says they're really malevolent. I mean, that is malevolent. It is malevolent for a scientist to cook the data of their results, to present it in one way rather than another, because it's good for them financially. They get grants. It's a preposterous claim, in my view. There's no evidence for it. But that's the sort of view that's backed by this free market ideology. It's backed by this idea that government causes more problems than it solves. The problem with that argument is, I mean, I think the argument is wrong on its own terms. I think governments are often incompetent, but frequently competent. And there are malevolent actors in government, but mostly government policies are motivated by genuine efforts to solve problems as best as they can under constraints. But the problem, if you believe that, is that all of the underlying causes of environmental problems require an active, democratic, affirmative state. They all require some kind of public intervention to solve. Free riding problems require governments to change the payoffs. Negative externalities require government intervention to neutralize the advantage of negative externalities, to force corporations to internalize the costs which they'd like to displace on others. Corporate power, a truly democratic state, is needed to counteract the power of corporate actors. And hyper-consumerism, again, we'll talk about this next week, government policy is needed to shift the priorities for the use of productivity. Productivity to create more freedom of time for people rather than always biased towards increasing consumption. Well, we'll talk about that next week. So the key idea is that excessive faith in the market prevents robust government intervention to solve these problems. Well, all of these ideas can be applied to global warming. Hyper-consumerism, collective action failures among governments, negative externalities, NIMBY movements, and power and climate denial, all of these are relevant to understanding the problem of global warming. I don't have time to go through each of these carefully, although I think what I'll do is spend a little bit of time on this now, and we'll begin the next lecture by wrapping up the environmental discussion. I think the environmental issues and global warming in particular are sufficiently pressing, and they bear on the public transportation questions we'll be looking at next time anyway, since it's one of the parts of the solutions. Okay, so let me just begin this discussion. Hyperconsumerism, well, hyperconsumerism is what leads people to decide that as soon as gas prices go down, the sale of small cars decline and SUVs increases. There's been a discussion in the press recently about why small car production is now all shifted to Mexico. It's because Mexicans continue to buy small cars. Americans, since oil prices went down due to the Great Recession and the glut of oil from the intensification of oil drilling under Obama, because of all of that, oil prices are low in the United States now. And as a result, consumers shift to buying enormous cars and pickup trucks, even if they rarely have need for such heavy machinery. That hyperconsumerism contributes to global warming. Collective action failures among governments. There's a particular kind of free rider problem that faces global warming, which is the absolutely crucial role of coordination and collective action among governments, rather than having global warming simply being solved one by one by individual governments. You need treaties and collective actions. And that's really hard. That adds an additional layer of problem. It's not just what our country does, it's what all countries do. Negative externalities. Well, negative externalities are a central part of the problem of global warming. Displacing costs onto future generations is at the heart of the time horizon problem for how we think about whether we should do something serious. If it's 10 or 20 or 30 years down the road that the worst effects are going to be felt, but we are called upon to make sacrifices right now, some people say it's just not worth it. Is it worth paying these costs for a reduction in carbon emissions for global warming if the main beneficiaries will be people in the future, even if some of those people happen to be alive today? The temptation to kick it down the road and to have the problem confronted only when it actually becomes a catastrophe is extremely high. And that temptation is played on politically. It's part of the political dynamics that lead to an erosion of political support for doing something about global warming. NIMBY movements and global warming. There's been some interesting protests in fashionable areas on the coast in the Northeast over the creation of wind farms offshore. So wind farms, giant turbines lining the horizon off of Cape Cod, would generate significant amounts of electricity. And wealthy residents of Cape Cod, who in other circumstances are very pro-environment, say this is visual pollution and oppose the building of wind farms. That's a NIMBY problem. They want wind electricity, they just don't want to have to look at it. Okay, 12:15, we'll finish this up on Tuesday. See you then.